the OTB Podcast Network.
The Bernard Brogan Podcast and OTB Sports with Super Value. The stands may be silent, but supporting where you're from has never been so important. Super Value, supporting the GAA All-Ireland Football Championship for over 11 years. Bringing you the best of GAA conversations.
How are you doing? You're very welcome to the Bernard Brogan Podcast on OTB Sports. Brought to you by Super Value, proud sponsors of the Championship 2020. For my very first guest, I'm delighted to say I have my pal, Tadhg Kennelly, on the line. Hey, Tadhg.
Bernard, how are you, boy?
I am good. How are things?
Good. It's not meant. I'm in my kitchen at the other side of the world. Crazy times, but good. We're healthy.
You're looking well. You're looking fit. You're still doing a bit of training, I see.
Oh, why wouldn't I? Come on, man. You know my ego. I let myself go.
Looking bronze. Come here. Yeah.
Might start coming back soon, I'd say, you know. You never know.
Looking good. Come here, before we get into it, I'm going to talk about ego. Kerry boys, two of your AFL guys battled out at the end with Tommy and Mark. And I'd say you're sad to see Kerry falling down in a year that they would have probably had good aspirations.
So you can't start the podcast with this, man.
I want to get out of the way and be done with it because I don't want to talk about...
Yeah, disappointing, man. You know, just... They probably took him a small bit lightly, you think, you know, and they were a better team, just didn't get it done. And the way it finished, you know, and Tommy, you know, it's hard to take. And he's worked his backside off to get him back in there, Tommy, you know, and he's playing well and everything he's done, you know, since he's got back. And it's hard to stomach, you know. People don't understand, man. Well, you will, but people don't understand how much of a hatred there is between Kerry and Cork. It's the only team Kerry people are good at in sport is Gaelic football against Cork. They're better enough at everything else in sport, as far as Olympians, as far as hurling, as far as whatever it is. But we've got them in football, and it's when they get us in football, it's hard to take. You know, there's a rivalry there that's insane.
But that rivalry always brings it down to a level playing field, doesn't it? It always makes that battle always that bit tighter than on form, on paper. Kerry are a different standard, but I suppose the weather and the conditions make it just even it up, don't they?
It is, man. And look, you know what? And that's what makes it. I think that's what makes, you know, you're going back now to the format of the championship, you know, which was quite exciting, obviously, you know, when we were growing up. And, you know, you knew there was Kerry Cork, obviously, amongst the final, the majority of the time, obviously, in Leinster was. You know, the Dublin meet and, you know, you go out west to Connacht. And that one day, you know, whether it was in Parky Kiev or Fitzgerald Stadium, it was huge in the calendar. And it came back to that a small bit, you know, the younger generation now coming through would have seen the effects of, well, that's it, one game, you're gone. See you later, you know, and it makes it even harder to stomach, you know. If it was, you know, last year, I'd have no doubt probably Kerry would go on to win the All-Ireland because of the result. But they don't get the chance now, do they?
Yeah, it's a bitter championship this year. It's do or die, which makes it interesting. You've seen a couple of upsets, and we'll make interest in watching for us to have a bit of sport later on into the winter. But before, yeah, that's enough kind of talk about Kerry and their challenges. But how are things going in Sydney for all of us over here? We haven't chatted to you in a while. I know we couldn't get post across to our loved ones into Australia for a while. But how have things been there?
It's been untouched, really. We're like in another planet here compared to what's happening in the rest of the world, you know. Everything's going on. Initially, when it happened, like, it was, you know, we were, like everyone else, just shut down. And we basically, the country here, they closed the border, like, and there was no one in and out of the country. And it pretty much saved the country from you know, second cases and second outbreaks. And, you know, we're able to here survive on our own, you know, because we're so far away and the country's got a lot of money behind it. So there's small breakouts every now and then, you know, but Melbourne was the only one that when Melbourne got hit, they basically closed the borders of Melbourne. Like, it'd be like closing, you know, the Leinster border, and no one's allowed up into Dublin, and that's it, or no one's allowed out of Dublin, and they closed it to protect the rest of the country. Yeah, they've done some drastic measures, but again, they've got the money to do it, you know. And,
yeah.
Even now, like, to leave, you know, for me to go home, it's the longest time actually I've never gone back home, you know. I've been here 20 years. You just don't know if you can come back in because there's only 300 people allowed into the country a day.
Wow.
And they're driven straight to a hotel and put into quarantine for 2 weeks. So it's it's a strange world, you know. But we're surviving here. Like, there's people going to sport. Like, the grand finals run 2 weeks ago, you know, there was 35,000-40,000 people at it because they've done well to manage it, you know.
So things are going as normal, which is good. How are you seeing much of the Irish abroad there? How are they getting on, the young guys and girls that went across work and stuff? Are they coping all right, do you think?
They are. I feel sorry, you know, a friend of mine, if something happens at home, you know, and you can't, to get back, no, you can leave, like, you know, but coming back in, you're not too sure you're going to actually get back in. And that's the issue. Like, what they're doing is they're issuing airline tickets for people, like, but you get to the, say you go home and you spend your couple of weeks at home or whatnot, and you get to, say, Dublin Airport, and you can't come in, you're not one of the 300 people load in today into Australia, and you got to go back and rebook a ticket, and you don't know when you're going to get back in. So there's something like 30,000, now 28,000 Australians that can't come back home because that's the way they're doing it at the minute.
Wow.
So the areas, like, the pubs are open, bars are open, there's lots of barbecues and parties, outdoor gatherings. Now you're allowed to have 30 people. You know, if music venues have started to open up the last couple of weeks, so I was in an Irish bar not too long ago. So
that's cool. I remember in 2011, I think I did a stint over there with you, and Coogee Bay Hotel, I think you brought us to for a few pints, and then you brought us to some fancy place in Sydney, and we were way over depth. I was traveling the coast with a rucksack, and you were there with all the AFL guys swanning around the place. But how's all your colleagues? Are you still staying in touch? How's Goodsy having the?
Yeah, they're good, boy. They're good. Like, it's funny in a way, because of the less travel here, you know, Australian people love to travel also, you know, and love to go away, and when a lot of people are actually around, and there's lots of us catching up regularly, you know, to the demise of my wife and three children. I'm probably catching up too much with them, but you know, you're out and about, and because people aren't flying anywhere, aren't leaving, you know, most people are hanging around Sydney or they're around, and there's lots of catching up. But yeah, it is that we've actually reconnected an awful lot more probably this year than ever, the Swannies boys. Funnily enough, we've just got a lunch coming up actually in the next couple of days, which is going to be a big gathering. But it is, you can hold your own too, Bruno, boy. Don't worry about Adams, don't worry about the Coogee Bay, no, come on.
I know, we're just looking forward to those. We're looking forward to getting back out with our friends and families and stuff for a few pints. We're locked down fairly hard here, but to bring it back to, obviously we know each other a long time. Pope and Reardon in Listowel, for those who don't know, obviously a big part of my heart, and played a lot of football down the backfield and down the back lane, where my granny and granddad's house was. Listowel to you, and what did it mean to you growing up? I know it was a big part of you playing with the Emmets. Obviously, I went down to watch you several times, and I love going down there in the summers. It was a big part. Home was a big part for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, huge, man. It's like, I suppose you're the one person, I suppose, you can probably relate to this in a small way with your father, you know. Watching, you know, we watched the Kerry Golden years, but you know, it was something that the town itself is got such a meaning towards everything that I've ever done, you know, because, and even coming back out here or coming out here to play, you know, it was a lot of the driving force for me was to not go back to Listowel having not played one game of AFL football, because I would have felt I'd left the town down, you know. No, I love Kerry and I love Ireland, obviously, but it was all Listowel. It was always that make the town proud, make your parish or where you come from extremely, extremely proud, you know. And that's Listowel. Like, Listowel is just a great town, some great people, great support, you know. And it's struggling at the moment, you know. There's business closing and whatnot, and everything that's going on. But my youth was absolute joy, Jesus, you know. Sorry, but you know, I spend the time my brother and my friends just kicking the ball. That's what I did. I was outside, you know, spent the majority of the time outside playing sport, and it was soccer or football. But it was the love of the town, you know, that really drove me an awful lot to a lot of my stuff that I did in my career, really. Bernard, it was that's where I learned my trade, you know. You talk about people turning and going professional. No, it was a different sport, but there's a lot of similarities. But that's where I learned my craft was at home in Listowel, playing against my friends, with my friends, up against the gable in the pub, you know. That's
yeah. And I get asked this question a lot about the legacy in your dad playing before, and obviously your late dad been a legend of Kerry. How much do you think, like look at the Brogans, look at Dean Rock and Barney, you look at yourself and your dad, you look at Tommy Walsh, you look at even the Spillanes, Adrian Spillane and Tom Spillane. What does that make somebody a different person, or what? How has that helped, or how does that help us, I suppose? I lived through it as well, but what's your answer to that when people ask you about your heritage and your legacy, and did that make you become a footballer? Did that drive you down that path to play GAA or AFL?
Yeah, a lot of people say it, you know. We used to joke around, myself and my brother, you know, whenever we were coming through, you know, I was 16, 17, 18, while in minors and whatnot, you know, and it always been the paper, you know, son of the legendary Tim Kennelly, and we joke with my father, you know, that people would, he'd be long forgotten if it wasn't for his two sons consistently putting his name in the newspaper, you know. And I loved it, you know. People might say you're living in the shadow of your dad and whatnot, but I never once thought of it like that at all, you know. I suppose it was like majority young men, you know, you idolise your father, and if your dad was a butcher, well, guess what, you're probably going to be a butcher. If your dad's a doctor, well, you're probably going to be a doctor. But the fact of the matter is, my father was a captain for Kerry and won 5 All-Ireland medals, so that's what I wanted to do, you know, and Noel was no different, and we loved it, you know. We loved the fact that, you know, he was such a popular guy, and the influence he had in us as a father. But he's just your dad, you know. If we didn't see him as Tim Kennelly, the legendary footballer, he was dad, and I'd tell him to piss off every now and then, and we'd have a fight, and he'd chase after me, and he'd try and tell me what to do and how to play the game properly, or why didn't I do this in the game, and I'd just, you know, turn my back on him, and because that's what you do with your dad, you know. And that's I do think the fact that I basically spent my childhood in a dressing room, because that's where dad was, and I was his shadow, you know, and my brother was, you know. And you learn the intricacies of football very quickly, yeah. And you're around it all the time, and in every conversation you're in, it's Gaelic football, because he loved it so much, and we were following him, and that's a big strength, I think, when young fellas are coming through. And obviously the bloodlines and whatnot is part of it, but the ability side of it, but I think that it does help being around, you know, dressing rooms and the game all the time.
Yeah, it gives you that bit of extra fight, maybe, that to keep us with it, I suppose, and maybe that's why we hung on to it for so long. But obviously coming home was a big part. I know you've told a story before, but in 2009, when you came home and leaving obviously a very successful AFL career with an amazing team in the Sun, what was your reflecting back on it, your motives in 2009? Was it to just, obviously Kerry had went through a couple of a bit successful years, like 3 or 4 All-Irelands in the decade. Was it just what you wanted a piece of it, or was it what was home calling you? What was their main motive for coming home?
My father passed away, Bernard. You know, I always thought I'd go back. You know, I see Conor McKinn at the moment, you know, he's come back home, and he's, I always knew, you know, within myself that I was going to go back at some stage, yeah, and try and play for Kerry. And dad passed away then suddenly, you know, and it kind of just sped that process up. Now, that was in the 2005, and I didn't go back to 2009, but I came back out in 2006 and 2007 and played. And I picked up a couple of bad injuries in the 2007 and 8 season, and I went, oh, if I don't do it now, you know, I'm not going to get a chance to actually be at my best and be able to offer what I want to be able to offer. And I was pushing on towards 13. I decided then, you know, it was kind of, right now was the time I was getting injured, and it was a lot of it was, you know, to like I said before, like, I grew up wanting to play for Kerry, and I think as a Listowel man and a Kerry man, you're nothing in Gaelic football until you win an All-Ireland medal in Kerry, and probably some people will say five or six of them, but that's a Dublin thing now, isn't it? but that's what it is, you know. You're expected to win All-Irelands, and you know, and that was probably, you know, it was a thing I wanted, a bucket I wanted to have a crack at. And the whole process probably sped up at that stage with dad passing away so suddenly, and then the injuries. Yeah. I had 2 years to go on a contract, and I left it, you know. As my wife says, it's probably the worst financial decision of my life.
Yeah, but it shows what matters to you, you know. It shows fairness to you. Yeah, you came and like you always do, you're like a cat, you always fall on your feet. You come home for 1 year and you get the All-Ireland done. You're the look of the Irish.
It wasn't easy, man. Jeez, it wasn't easy. Like, I actually thought it'd be easier, you know, because I'd played the international rules, you know, nearly every year, nearly every second year, you know, and I'd felt like, you know, that I was well able for, you know, the best. And I generally done that because I consistently wanted to see where I was at myself with the top range Gaelic footballers in the country. You know, and I played it a lot when I probably shouldn't have played a couple of times and through injuries, but I wanted to play to see where I was at and was I still up to it, you know, and was I still able to keep going with the best in the country, you know. And, and because I was able to, it used to give me confidence to go, all right, okay, I'm okay now. I'm okay with this level, kind of. I don't need to rush to get it back and all that kind of thing. And that helped a small bit my confidence to go back. But it wasn't easy, boy. It wasn't easy. You know, I'd spent 10 years kicking an oval ball, like.
Yeah.
The natural habits of, you know, of doing something was becoming unnatural again, the Gaelic football. And I remember going back and I'd struggled, man, to kick the wrong ball. I never thought I'd say it, you know. And it was, you know, my brother said to me, and he said this to me, he goes, do you remember when we were young fellas, what we used to do? And I said, yeah, what? And he goes to me, the side of the pub, man, we used to just kick the ball off it, like, non-stop. And do you know what I did? I was working with the Kerry GA helping out the schools, you know, and I'd finish, you know, at 2 or 3 o'clock, and down in the handball area in Listowel, there I was, man, started kicking the ball non-stop. Yeah. I'm nearly 30 years of age, kicking the ball, right foot, left foot, outside of the boot. And within 2 weeks, man, I had it back, my technique of, you know.
Never thought of it like that, yeah, that you lose the kind of the finesse or the touch. Conor McKenna, how we impressed, I'm sure you watched a bit of the GA, how he came back into the round ball and really impressed, as if he'd been kicking his whole life, as you say. He must have been impressed with his standard of skills in the game.
Yeah. He's still very young too, you know, Conor. And I'd almost probably left it too long, you know. I'd been 10 years away from it, you know. Mm. And Conor is still relatively young in age and being away from playing Gaelic football. But a freak, absolute freak, you know. He's got a great temperament too, Conor. You know, he's got that temperament that he can take on the world and nothing can break him. And you know, the more he fails, the harder he's going to actually try and try and beat it, you know. So he's going to be a star for a long time at home.
Yeah. In 2009, when you came back, I'm going to ask you a question here. I remember Alan saying to me, my brother, he was obviously good pals with yourself and Mark O'Shea and over the years, and he said to me one day, I said, the lads are they're great lads, and obviously we have a graw for Kerry men and Kerry in general, so we'd always have massive respect for all of the players and yourself included. But Alan said to me one day, sure, it's easy for those lads to be nice to us and have a few points with us and bring us out for a few points around the stall. He says, when they're hammering us every day or every game, time we play. When you came back in 2009, what did you think of that Dublin team? Obviously, the Dublin team hadn't won any All-Irelands, but in your head, you're honest, kind of in that thought process, what was your thought on a Dublin team?
Always that there was the talent was there, but just couldn't get it together. Mm. You know, it was, Jesus, you look at the list, you know, I'm a lot better than I do, Bernard, like the players that didn't win All-Ireland medals. And just couldn't have the ability to actually come together and play as a unit. Always respected Dublin. I think probably goes back to a lot of, you know, obviously my father's days and whatnot, and knowing you guys and people from Dublin that we know. But I just think we knew that they couldn't play together as a team. And if you keep going at them, you break them, because they just didn't have that unity that you need really in the last quarter of a, you know, an All-Ireland semi-final, quarter-final, because, you know, they just hadn't been doing it for the, you know, 10, 12 years before that, really. And that was the mindset of it. You know, I'll never forget this, man, in the lead up to the draw against you guys for the quarterfinal in 2009. We're on the train back from Tullamore, and we snuck a win against Sligo, penalty. Dave Kelly missed, and David Murphy made a great save in Tralee. And then we went to Antrim and played Antrim, and we snuck a win. And then we're on the train back, and the draw comes through that we're playing Dublin in the quarterfinal. And I tell you, the atmosphere in that train changed like instantly, with a focus that I'd never seen before. I was in the camp going, oh man, it's not good. You know, we're struggling to get over to Sligo and Antrim, and it's only a matter of time before we're out. But the fact that we got the Dublin draw in the All-Ireland quarterfinal, no, in Croke Park, was what won us the All-Ireland, really. Mm. You know, I think if we got, you know, Cork, if we got, you know, another county, I don't think we would have won the game and we wouldn't have won the All-Ireland. I think it was Dublin and Croke Park and quarterfinal changed the psyche and the focus of that whole group. You got to remember that group had won a lot of All-Irelands, yeah. Two Bernards, like, you know, the Irish Shed, five All-Irelands, the six, like, the boys had plenty of All-Irelands and they were very tired. And I think that, once that came, just refocused the whole thing and off we went.
And you think that was it? There was a lot of miles in that team's legs. Obviously, Dublin 1010, where it was a different, it was a start of a new era for Dublin. What do you think changed in Dublin and similar again in Kerry over the next 10 years, I suppose?
I think Dublin just got it together, man. I think you got it together from you've always had the development structure in place, you know. I just think you probably got it. You've got it together. You're at the top end, at the pointy end of what it means to play for a team. And I see the Dublin team now that are almost a mirror image of what we've done as a football club out here for the Swans. The team ethos, your standards, behaviours, expectations, the leadership qualities that we talk about, and we've been doing it here for 15 years. It's almost carbon copy now when I see Dublin and when I hear the language coming out of the team, the language coming out of the management. It's carbon copy of, the All Blacks.
That's interesting,
And it's something I've known for a long time here, you know, and when I was playing in 2003, I came in 2000, you know, and the club was a basket case, but the head coach, Paul Roos, took over in 2000, halfway through 2002, 2003, and just basically changed the very fabric of the club through those standards and expectations and your language and the way we dealt with each other and behaviours and what was expected, not expected, and that way we were able to get success and it makes you feel like you belong to something that's more important to you as a player and as a person in a football club, and when you get that and when you get players thinking, well, this is bigger than who I am and playing together, you get what you get with your results, you know. It's no surprise Dublin are able to do what they've been able to do.
Yeah, and it was interesting. I chatted to Donaghy Ciarán there a couple of weeks ago, and he was quizzing me on, obviously, I released a book, and he was asking me a couple of things, nuggets he found around the mindset and the professionalism and that cultural piece that we really, you say it all there, that's exactly the mentality we were going after with Dublin, of a culture, of creating something more and bigger than yourself. And he was kind of saying, he kind of was pointing at the fact that maybe Kerry, especially at the end of 2009, didn't maybe have that. And did you see that when coming back from a professional group into 2009? I know he got the job done, but did you see inklings of that? And is that what has maybe held him up over the last 10 years?
Yeah, I think so. You know what's surprising? I think in that in the 2000s, you know, in that era with Kilkenny winning so many All-Irelands, I honestly think Dublin or Kerry underachieved. You know, and Kerry won All-Irelands, but. You know, underachieved as far as they could achieve more from the mindset mentality of we're unbeatable and should have went and won all Ireland's. And I genuinely think that. And a lot of people say that's a bit of a couple considering they won all Ireland's in 2000. But I genuinely think Kerry should have won more all Ireland's in that 12-13 year period, you know. And there was no reason they couldn't have done what Kilkenny are doing or what Dublin are doing right now. And I think it goes back to that mindset. You know, there's still the fabric of Kerry training was ruthless, boy. It was at each other for spots and places. And it was almost like the raw talent won games of football then the whole team perspective at times, you know. That's unique in itself to be able to win all Ireland's and do that because of the actual... But the talent was there and it's a seriously talented teams in the 2000s and whatnot that Kerry had. But I think if there was that mindset and that group and that whole togetherness, it would have been a lot more successful and it just wasn't there. And I think a lot of it's probably going back to the A versus B training games that we used to do the Sunday before, 2 weeks before a championship game was out of control. I played harder games in Killarney in training than I did in any championship game that I played that year. And that's the God honest truth. You know, there was no championship game that was as hard as some of those A versus B.
I've been there, absolutely.
That doesn't build team camaraderie, you know. That builds a bit of friction, and you know your talent can come through, you know. But for continued and long success and cultural success that you know and legacies that you're talking about, you really do need that the bonding and that closeness, you know.
And do you think that's not there in Kerry at the moment? Because the panel looks strong.
I'm not sure. Yeah, it's not, I'm not sure, Bernard. I mean, you know yourself, when you're not in there and you're only hearing things, you know, and you don't want to, you know, I don't want to speculate on it. It's easy to speculate when teams lose, you know, and people say, oh, well, it's not working, that's not working, you know, and teams have off days, as you know, Bernard, you know, and that's what happens a lot. I think they've done a great job, Kerry, and in basically, it's a brand new system, the way they've been able to come through development, win under 21, win minors, you know, Kerry will be fine. You know, I think they'll be okay, and I think they've done a better job with it now than they would have, we'll say, in the late 90s. And that team that's came through, and that those, you know, the O'Shea's and all the and Galvin's and all those, and Declan Sullivan, all those coming through. I think they've done a way better job now at it, and they've learned their lessons about how to get that team ethos and how to get galvanize it. Because, you know, Kerry people want success, boy, and you know, it's great, it's a great expectation to have on your shoulder. And because in Kerry, every young fella playing, whether they're talented or not, are given a Kerry jersey and they want to play for Kerry, whether they can or not. That's what they want to do, and we're very lucky that way, you know, in Kerry, and that's what drives the talent so much. Yeah. You know, as far as what's happening right now, it's like I said, it's a bit difficult, you know. I'm still close to it's there, fair. But.
It's hard to question, yeah. I suppose last week I would have said that they were going to be close to winning All-Ireland. It's easy to say things are wrong when a result goes like that. It's difficult circumstances at the moment. But I suppose what I'd love to get into...
You know, Bernard, the expectations are, you know, and that's coming back to being prepared properly and you know, having that age of, you know what, we're going to absolutely demoralise Cork, and it's as simple as that, and this is how we're going to do it. You know, and not having that, sometimes it can happen in Kerry. Oh, watch them, they're coming for you. Or, you know, you might slip up, or there's a banana skin here. You know, you, as you know yourself, having that real strong mindset of being, you know, relentless, that you're going to get it done no matter what. And it's not a cockiness, but it's a confidence knowing that you're going to get it done. And, you know, that I think wasn't there. I think in what I've, and a lot of it I'm hearing, you know, but from what I saw, it just weren't ruthless enough in actually getting the job done.
Yeah, no, it's fair. It's fair. But come here, I have the joy of playing alongside you in international rules. You mentioned it there. And like the international rules sometimes gets a bit of a stick, but I absolutely loved it. I got the chance to captain my country in 2015, like something I never even captained Dublin. It was massive for me. And I got to obviously get out for a few pints with the likes of Goodsy and Sam Gilbert and these guys, with yourself. And like, I had some of the best memories ever. It was a good story the night we had in Listowel. I don't know if I've ever talked to you about it since, but when yourself, myself, and
hang on, man, we can edit this, can't we?
We can edit this, if it doesn't, if you're not comfortable with it. But no, we were in John B's for the lock-in, and yourself, and we're all well behaved, and yourself and Tommy headed off and left per stories, Dave Moore, and wandering around John B's. So I said, right, come on, I put him around the arm around the shoulder and brought him home. And I put him, just threw him into one of the spare rooms in my mum's place down in the stall. And he obviously didn't know what was going on. He woke up the next morning, came out of the room sheepishly, walking down. He walked into the kitchen and saw me mother. And he goes, please be Mrs. Brogan. My mum goes, how are you doing? Are you young Ogie? So I'd given her the heads up. So, yeah, so those type of things. Like, I love getting out, having a few pints, meeting the likes of yourselves and the different county players. And, like, I love those days. And you played most years. I'm sure you would have loved those international rule days and trips across here and when they came to you over in Australia.
The best, man. The best memories I have. You know, some of the best of the trips that we had. And as you understand, a lot of it is you're in the season and you're belting the crap out of each other, you know. Mm-hmm. And in your way of playing for your country, and you know, it's right up there for me as well, right up there as far as what I've done in my career, playing for my country and playing. And I'm glad that I got the opportunity to be able to do it, you know. And that's where I'd hate for it to not be given to footballers, to not have the opportunity to do it. But some of the stories, man, as far as what we've done and got up to, were unbelievable, you know. And, you know, how long have we gotten? We certainly need to edit it. But it builds friendships, you know. And I remember a game we played and I had three teammates playing for Australia against me in Croke Park. And it was 2006, I think it was. Which one it was? In Dublin. And I played a good game, the first one, and a couple of the boys taught me, Adam Schneider and Big Baz, Barry Hall, had said, look, man, they've got your name on the board and they're coming for you, boy. There's a target on your head. And so I was ready to go, you know, once the game started. And I didn't see this fella. Came from behind me, Andrew Embley from West Coast Eagles, and he's just flattened me in the back right behind me, and I've gone down on my back, and I've kind of get up, and there's a bit of a schmozzle, and you know, Kieran McDonald, you know, from Mayo, the best left footers I've ever seen, is at half forward, and he's coming in, and he's jumping on top of fellas, and you know, he had the long blonde hair, and he comes out looking like a sheepdog, just a scraggy old sheepdog covered in hair, like I've got the blonde hair everywhere. And he was the one that came in and backed up, and from then on, man, we've been very close, you know. We connect and built a strong relationship. Or there's something that's just happened on the football field that he had my back, you know, and he came in over the top. And at the same time, I remember I was kind of, those punches being thrown, or what, handbags being thrown probably. And I grabbed someone, and it was actually Ryan O'Keefe, one of my own teammates in Sydney. We've kind of bought on that one, you know, and we stopped. But the friendship. I used to love connecting back with the Irish boys more so, because I didn't have the ability to do it, you know. I built a strong relationship with Star through it, you know. You know, we played a lot, and we obviously know each other and whatnot, but you know, you connect a lot with the Kerry boys also. But
yeah, as you say, when you go to war with someone and you've big Barry Hall coming after you, it's good to have a few pals like Kieran McDonald. And I don't know if you heard our good pal Graham Geraghty was sick there recently. We hear he's coming out the good side of it, who put it up to the Australian several times as well. So hopefully he's fitting well and continues his recovery. But the AFL, I watched obviously the grand final, and Zach and Mark been involved, and I hadn't watched it in a while. Obviously, obviously watched a lot of your journeys over the years, keeping a close eye on it. The game's really evolved for me. Like they're all 6'5". They're like, there's very little open play ball. It's very kind of ruck central. I just couldn't get over the kind of physicality and the way maybe it's just becoming a kind of a. I just couldn't. I just didn't see much open play. Maybe it was the grand final and the big occasion. Yes, has the game went like that over the last number of years?
It's going to happen at home, you know. And it's funny you say that, because I see an awful lot of what happens now. Obviously, being in the coaching game myself, I see a lot of what happens here. Models of it taken back to Gaelic football and taken home, you know, and taken over, you know. And, the press is huge in AFL, and has been for nearly 7-8 years now. The press is what I mean is. All 18 players, 18 players in the field in the AFL, they'll all be in one quarter of the field. If the ball is in, you say, let's it's cornerback, they'll have a whole lot up squeezing the ground and actually trying to stop the team from coming through. And they're trying to, it's like a basketball press. It's that's where it's came from, an American football press, but actually pressing, and they're trying to stop the flow of the game and making the game congested. They're big in their stats and numbers here, but the top two defensive teams in the competition, if you finish in the ladder, the end of the regular season before you went to the playoffs, whoever finished the top two in defence have won 18 of the last 19 premierships. So teams know, saying, well, you need to defend, you need to make it messy. And I see lots of the technical components going back, because there is obviously influences here that go back, and there's been coaches learning all the time. And it's something, you know, I've been proclaiming to a lot of Kerry people about beating the Dubs is pressing the crap out of that kick out, you know, and pressing it for a long time. And to the extent, I don't know if you remember, Bernard, when I was coaching the Australian team in the International Rules with Alex Clarkson, where we had our goalkeeper stand on the 45-metre line, and we had all players pressing up, and we won the game. And you were standing inside on your own many a time. And just couldn't get the ball through, you know, and it's a technique that can, it does need a lot of practice. You know, you got a lot of time to actually perfect it, because you know where your teammate is in relation to your teammate and your spacing and whatnot. So I get a bit technical there.
No, I totally agree with you. When you look at the evolution of AFL and you look at the physical nature of the noughties and the early 2000s of the Barry Halls, Ben Cousins, these lads who are just physically big. And then you look at Tyrone and Armagh in the early noughties about that physicality. And then it's gone into the AFL. And you've told me before about some of the pre-season training during your era, where it moved into more of a running game and athleticism. Obviously, GA has gone like that. It's about the Brian Fentons. These lads are going up and down the pitch, the wing forwards, Paddy Durkins, these players. Now it's gone into this press. And Dublin, we have done bits of it, and teams are starting to do it. I think, is that what the next kind of iteration is? Is that real full-court press? Because it takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of clarity about your role.
It's hard, man, because do you know what will happen, Bernard? Like, the ball will get through and they'll score goals. You know, but the ideology behind it is that if you stop it getting through enough, you're going to score more than the opposition. Now, it looks bad when it gets through because they've got no defenders on them. and it gets through. But if your system's strong enough, now that takes a lot of confidence as a manager and as a coach to do it, you know. And I'm talking to Blue in the face, talking to Star about it, you know. When you were playing Dublin, so we were playing you 3 years ago, you know, and it was about pressing it and aiming did it in the first half, you know. And as far as that surprise factor. But I've no doubt someone will grab the bull by the horns and do it, you know, and have success with it. And we saw with, you know, the players getting behind the ball and playing the puke football as that's playing with that. Yeah. But, you know, it will change. It'll break, you know. It's just have someone to have the confidence to actually break it and go with it. Because it's only going to trickle down to club teams and whatnot if you do see that, you know.
I think you're right. You're seeing this. It's all built off stats. You've seen it even in soccer. You look at, like, Liverpool pressing forward. Like, every game now is obviously because as the game's evolved, stats and these data points come in. And I think you're dead right. Lastly, on the AFL, like, I saw a thing. Donegal Boyle put something in the paper a couple of weeks ago, and it was around the amount of players that have went over the last number of years, young guys on the experiment project. And I know you were heavily involved in a lot of them. Not many, or only a few of them, actually went on to actually play actual championship football. What are AFL looking for, or what are these players not having that isn't getting them over the line to actually play? Because they're obviously great athletes and they're the best of sometimes the counties here, but they don't seem to always get over the line. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a good question, man. It's not easy. Like, it's, you know, when I was doing the recruiting stuff, you know, it was the first thing I'd say to the 18, 19, 20-year-olds, I'd stand in front of them and say, look, I promise you the world here, but it's highly unlikely you're going to make it. You know, there's three players that have played over 150 games of AFL football, which is over 10 years. You know, it's hard. You're coming from a background, obviously, that's different, and you're going into a professional environment, and majority of them come out as big fish at home. You know, and then you come out, man, and you're in the bottom of the pile at an AFL club. You've got no idea what's going on. Your ego takes a hit. You know, and as you know, being a sports person, a lot of your stuff is about your ego and your bravado and how you actually can fake it yourself about how good you are. But when you're in an environment where you're actually not good at it and you're away from home and there's other factors that are brought into play, it's hard to do, you know. And people, the game's different. No matter what people say to you, they're different. The skills that are transferable, yes, but the games are totally different. Like, let's be honest. You know, they're extremely different. There's transferable things that are part of the game, but it's different. And when you've got someone that's coming in at 18, 19 into a game that these are fellas have been playing it their whole life and they're professional, and to break it, it's difficult, you know. But what we are showing, we've got a capability that we can do it. What we do need is more to actually try and break through, and more Zachs playing 200 games of AFL football, and Mark O'Connor, who's in the leadership group at Geelong, team playing the grand final. He's only 3 years into his career, you know. So, but it's a hard one to answer directly for you, man. But there's parts of it that's difficult because of the outside influence of being away from family, obviously, and the welfare. But the fact that that's a totally different game is another factor.
And is it down to physical attributes? Is it down to mental?
No. I don't think it's physical at all. I don't think it's the, you know, we're competitive. We're competitive, man. We know how to fight, like, and we know how to get the job done if we have to, you know. I just think you're chasing the eight ball an awful lot. You're just chasing it, you know, and you need a club that's willing to stay with you and back you in and say, well, there are going to be mistakes. It's going to be a long journey, and you need a club that's got a really strong program. And it's really the better clubs that are showing, the top four, six clubs, that they can do it because they're willing to actually spend the money and the time to actually invest in the player. Yeah. Whereas a lot of players here, man, they got 1-2 years at the club. See you later. It's not even 2 years. It's 1 year at 18, and if you're there because they've just got the abundance of talent that are there, you know?
Yeah.
That you need the better clubs to be able to invest in it and hang tough and find fight for you, you know?
Yeah, and obviously there's been several, as I'm sure you know well, the ladies footballers have gone across. I think it's amazing, and I know you've taken heat over the years about different counties not been happy with you offering a professional career for a player, but what an opportunity for a young guy or girl to go across there and play sport in a professional environment, to do what you love every day. Obviously, to use our GA skills to bring us somewhere. I think it's amazing to offer. Obviously, no county team wants to lose their top players, but for the individual, what an amazing thing. Do you think that Ireland will still be looked at as a hunting ground or a watering hole for future AFL? I know that the ladies is only growing, the men as well. Do you still think there's confidence in Ireland for future players?
The main criticism I got, Bernard White, was not taking more dubs, actually, the past five or 6 years. You know, it would have been a different story. I would have been an icon. I would have put a statue of me blind and stole it by taking a few more dubs, took a few more dubs off. But yeah, look, it's going to happen because, like I said to you, the more Mark O'Connor's can do it, you know, and we can do it. And the proof is there that we can do it. Now, the numbers are stacked against you. We talk about a game that's big on numbers, but there is players that are doing it and having big influences in clubs, you know. And certainly the female avenue, and I think, I don't know whether it's because the game here, the female game is not as professional for as long as the AFL men's game. I'm not sure. What's the major difference in the two, that the females seem to be adapting to the transition quicker than the male counterparts in AFL transition. You know, and we're seeing that with the girls being very successful coming out here straight away and playing within a few months. That's unheard of I also think the talent pool is a lot less for the female talent right now in AFL as far as the standard wise, because it's still a young baby as far as it picking up and getting there. You know, it's going to be a beast because the following is going through the roof. The AFL membership is enormous. The following it has is huge. You know, but it's certainly it's going to continue. And even in this current environment, you know, with COVID and whatnot, clubs are still going to go and try and find a way to be, to get an edge, because that's what professional high performance teams do. Mm-hmm. They try and get an edge wherever they can, you know, whether that's getting an Irish player, whether it's getting a player that plays basketball in the United States, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, cutting edge technology or cutting edge sports science. That's what high performance teams do. And AFL is no different than any other professional sport. They're going to do that, you know. And, mm-hmm. And it is, look, I was absolutely joy to be, mm-hmm. to be able to offer it to young people. It never really bothered me that people say, oh, you're taking talent from Ireland, you know. We're losing talent to other codes anyway. And you know what? I'm glad someone gave me the opportunity to do it. And I'm not going to stop trying to give young people an opportunity. It was my mindset to try and give young men in Ireland, the Gaelic footballers certainly, the opportunity to be professional footballers, you know. And, albeit if the game was professional at home, you know, I wouldn't have left for sure. You know, that's another argument, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's amazing. And for yourself, I know you've had sport in your DNA since you were born, and you were lucky enough to play AFL for a long, long time, and come home and win your All Ireland, and stay involved, I suppose, in that kind of. That project to give that avenue for young men and women to play AFL. What's the future hold for Tadhg Kennelly? I suppose we don't hear enough from you in Ireland. We always like to hear how you're getting on and stuff like that. For people who are interested, what's the future hold for you and Nicole and the gang? Or is Sydney bound for long haul? Or any time coming home to us soon? Or what's the plans?
We know us, man. I'll tell you, it's three small children. It's not easy. But when I finished up the recruiting, you know, about 4 years ago, you know, and I went coaching, you know, and I started, I went on the coaching journey and I started going, well, maybe this is where I want to go. And COVID and a few things have just kind of went, you know what, I don't want to move. At the minute with a young family, we didn't want to move in these days. So I left the club. Only a month ago now, as a coach, and I took up a job as a director of sport at a school here.
Brilliant.
A major school, which brilliant. Is brilliant. Albeit, who knows for how long and what. It's just right now, it's just not right for us to move. You know, it's just difficult for both families, as you know, man, with children. But as far as going home, never say never. Mm. I've always said that. It's been 20 years. But it's been a wild journey, man. You know, the game has given me so much. And I'll go back to the original question you asked me, man. It wasn't for the people in the store that taught me everything about respect and responsibility, about who I am, where I come from, be proud of it. And it drove me an awful lot to have the success that I had as a footballer and now as a coach. Mm.
Well, thanks a million, Tadhg. I think, yeah, your new role as director of sport, I think that that group of young guys and girls will have the right mindset, and will only benefit from your advice and your energy and your passion, I suppose, for sport. So for me, this is my first podcast. I really appreciate your time. I'm not sure what time of the day it is in Sydney. It's probably late in the evening. So I know you have a busy family.
Good morning, you know what I'm doing for you.
Huh?
It's 4 a.m. You don't even know what I'm doing for you. Getting
Well, you're probably up anyway, going for your morning run by the looks of you. But no, thanks a million, and hopefully we'll see you soon, and I appreciate your time.
Anytime, Burner Boy. Thanks.
Cheers, my man. Thank you very much for tuning into episode 1 of the Burner Brogan podcast, brought to you by Super Value, proud sponsors of the 2020 Championship. I'm delighted to announce that Tommy Bow will be our guest next week on episode 2. Please keep an eye on OTB channels for updates.
The Bernard Brogan Podcast and OTB Sports with Super Value. The stands may be silent, but supporting where you're from has never been so important. Super Value, supporting the GAA All-Ireland Football Championship for over 11 years, bringing you the best of GAA conversations.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.